of two different posters were still on the wall. On one side was a little bit of a movie poster with the name Johnny written on it. Beside that one, and sticking out a bit, was a poster advertising cigars with, yes, you guessed it, only the word cigar sticking out. And she liked it, I continued for him. And she called me Johnny Cigar. Her parents, you know, they had thrown her out. And the man who was my father had dumped her, so she absolutely refused to use either of those family names for me. And all the way through the labor, when she gave birth to me on that footpath, she stared at those birds, Johnny Cigar, and she took it as a sign, if you'll forgive the joke. She was a very, very stubborn woman. He looked at the little stage, watching as Jitendra, Satish, and others lifted flat pieces of plywood onto the frame to make the floor. It's a good name, Johnny, I said after a while. I like it, and it brought you good luck. He smiled at me, and the smile became a laugh. I'm just glad it wasn't an advert for laxatives or some such, he spluttered, causing me to laugh and spray tea at him in return. It's taking you guys quite a while to tie the knot, I observed when we could talk again. What's the delay? Kumar, you know, he wants to play the successful businessman and put a dowry with each of his daughters. Prabhaka and I, we told him we don't believe in all that. We don't want a dowry, you know. It's kind of old-fashioned, all that stuff. Mind you, Prabhaka's dad is not quite of the same opinion. He sent down a list from the village, a list of dowry gifts he has in mind. He wants a gold watch, a Seiko automatic, and a new bicycle, among other stuff. The model of bicycle he wants, the one he picked out for himself, we told him it's too big. We told him that his legs are too damn short to reach the pedals, let alone the ground, yeah. But he's crazy for that bicycle. Anyway, we're waiting for Kumar to collect all his dowry and such. The weddings are set for the last week in October, before all the Diwali and all that. That'll be quite a week. My friend Vikram gets married that week too. You're coming to the weddings, Lynn? He asked, with a small, tight frown. Johnny was a man who granted favours to others with selfless generosity. As is often the case with such men, he couldn't ask for them or express his wishes with anything like the same ease. I wouldn't miss it for the world, I replied, laughing. I'll be there with bells on. I mean that literally. When you hear the bells ringing, you'll know I'm on my way. When I left him, he was talking to Satish. The boy listened intently and stared into his face, his eyes as expressionless as a gravestone. And I remembered how he'd clutched at my leg on the day that Carla had visited me in the slum, how he'd favoured her with a shy, sincere smile. The memory sliced into my dead heart. It said that you can never go home again, and it's true enough, of course. But the opposite is also true. You must go back, and you always go back. And you can never stop going back, no matter how hard you try. Needing distraction, I rode my bike out to the RK Film Studios, gunning the engine and swerving too often and too fast between the cars. I'd hired 8 foreigners the day before and had sent them to Lisa. It wasn't difficult for me to find and convince foreigners to fill non-speaking roles in the Bollywood films. The same German, Swiss, Swedish or American tourists who would have reacted with mistrust and hostility to Indian casting agents responded enthusiastically when I approached them. In the years that I'd lived in the slum and worked as a tour guide, I'd met every kind of foreign tourist. I developed a style in dealing with them that won their trust quickly. That style was 2 parts showman, 2 parts flatterer, and 1 part philanderer, combined with a hint of mischief, a sniff of condescension, and a pinch of contempt. The work as a tour guide had also given me friendships in several key Calabar restaurants. For years, I'd steered my tour parties into the Café Mondega, the Piccadilly, Dipti's Juice Bar, Edward VIII, Mezban Restaurant, Apsara Café, the Strand Coffee House, the Ideal, and others in the tourist beat. and encouraged them to spend their money. When I needed foreigners to fill bit parts in the Bollywood films, I trawled those cafes and restaurants. The owners, managers, and waiters always greeted me warmly. Whenever I saw a suitable group of young men and women, I approached them with the offer of a chance to work in an Indian movie. With the restaurant staff vouching for me, I usually secured their confidence and agreement within a few minutes. I then phoned Lisa Carter to arrange transport for the following day. The system worked well. In the few months since we'd started working together, Lisa was drawing casting work from the major studios and producers. Finding the most recent group, the foreigners I'd hired the day before, was our first job for the famous RK studio. I was curious to see the large, prestigious studio complex. And as I rode through the entrance gates, my spirits lifted to the tall grey sails of the corrugated gable roofs. For Lisa Carter and others like her, the dream world of movies inspired an almost reverential awe. I wasn't awed by the movie world, but I wasn't immune to it either. Every time I entered the fantasy land of a film studio, a little of the magic that makes a movie caught in my heart and lifted me, bright with surprise, from the gloomy sea that too much and too often my life had become. The guards directed me to a soundstage where Lisa and her group of Germans were waiting. I'd arrived during a break in the shooting and found Lisa serving coffee and tea to the young foreigners. They were seated at two tables, two of several that were arranged around a stage, on a set that was designed to replicate a modern nightclub. I greeted them, exchanged a few pleasantries, and then Lisa took me aside. "How are they?" I asked her when we were alone.
"They're great," she answered happily. "They're patient and relaxed and having a good time, I think. This'll be a good shoot. You've sent some pretty good people in the last couple of weeks, Lynn. The studios are real pleased. We could really work this into something, you and me."
"You like this, don't you?"
"Sure I do," she said, giving me a smile I could feel on the back of my head.
Then her expression shifted into something more solemn, something determined. The kind of determination you find in people who do it all the hard way, without hope. She was beautiful, a California beach beauty in the carnal jungle of Bombay, a pom-pom girl who'd pulled herself out of the death by leeches of heroin and the sybaritic suffocation of Madame Jo's palace. Her skin was clear and tanned. Her sky-blue eyes were radiant with resolve. Her long, curly blonde hair was pulled back from her face and held in an elegant coiffure that complemented the decorousness of her modest, ivory-coloured pantsuit. "She beat heroin," I found myself thinking as I met her stare. "She beat it. She got off the stuff." I was suddenly aware of how brave she was, and that the courage in her, when you knew it was there, and you knew how to look for it, was as palpable and riveting as the fierce impersonal menace in a tiger's eye.
"I like this gig," she said. "I like the people and the work. I like the life. I think you should like it too."
"I like you," I smiled. She laughed and slipped an arm through mine, leading us in a stroll around the set. "The movie's called Panch Papi," she said. "Five kisses."
"No, papi, not puppy. That's the play on words. Papi means thief, and puppy means kiss. So it's really five thieves. But there's a joke about it being five kisses as well, because it's a romantic comedy. The female lead is Kimi Katkar. I think she's gorgeous. She's not the best dancer in the world, but she's a beautiful girl. The male lead is Chunky Pandey. He could be good, real good, if his head wasn't jammed so far up his own ass.
While we're on the subject, have you had any more trouble with Maurizio?"
"Not a thing from him. But I'm worried about Ulla. She's been gone for a whole day and night. She took a call from Modena the night before last and left in a hurry. It was the first time he surfaced in weeks. I haven't heard from her since, and she promised to call."
I rubbed the frown from my forehead,
up through my untidy hair.
"All I know is what she's doing," I growled. "She's not your problem and she's not mine. I helped her because she asked me to, because I like her. But I'm getting tired of this Ulla Maurizio Modena thing, you know what I mean? Did Modena say anything to her about the money?"
"I don't know. Maybe."
"Well, it's still missing, and so is Modena. The boys on the street have been telling me. Maurizio's going around all over the place looking for Modena. He won't give up until he finds him. And Ulla's no better. $60,000. That's not all that much, but people have been killed for less. If Modena's got it, he'd better stay clear of Ulla while Maurizio's still after him."
"I know. I know."
Her eyes were suddenly glazed and apprehensive. "I'm not worried about Ulla," I said more softly. "I worry about you. If Modena's back, you should stay close to Abdullah for a while. Or me." She looked at me with her lips pressed to white rims around what she wanted to say, but couldn't or wouldn't.
"Tell me about the scene," I suggested, trying to shift us from the cold black whirlpool that Ulla's life was becoming. "What's going on in this movie?"
"It's a nightclub, or at least it's a movie version of one. The hero steals a jewel from a rich politician, I think, something like that, and he runs in here to hide. He watches the girl, Kimi, doing a big dance number, and he falls for her. When the cops show up, he hides the jewel in her wig. The rest of the movie is about how he tries to get close to her to get the jewel back."
She paused, studying my face, and trying to read the expression in my eyes.
I guess you think it's kind of stupid.
"No, I don't," I laughed. "I like it. I like all this. In the real world, the guy would just beat her up and take his jewel back. He might even shoot her. I like the Bollywood version better."
"So do I," she said, laughing. "I love it. They put it all together from painted canvas and skinny pieces of wood, and it's like they're making dreams or something. I know that sounds corny, but I mean it. I love this world, Lynn, and I don't want to go back to the other one."
"Hey, Lynn," a voice called out from behind me. It was Chandra Mehta, one of the producers. "You got a minute?"
I left Lisa with the German tourists and joined Chandra Mehta beneath a metal gantry that supported a complex tree of bright lights. He wore a baseball cap backwards, and the press of the tight band made his plump face seem rounder. Faded blue Levi's were buttoned up under his expansive paunch, and a long quarter shirt almost covered it from above. He was sweating in the mildly humid air of the closed set.
"Hey, man, how is it? I've been wanting to see you, yeah?"
His voice was breathy with conspiracy.
"Let's go outside and get some air. I'm boiling my fucking bonus off in here, yeah?"
As we strolled between the metal-domed buildings, actors in costume crossed our path, together with men carrying props and pieces of equipment. At one point, a group of 9 pretty dancing girls, dressed in exotic feathered costumes, passed us on their way to a soundstage. They turned my head around, forcing my body to follow it until I was walking backwards for a while. Chandra Mehta never gave them so much as a glance.
"Listen, Lynn, what I wanted to talk to you about," he said,
touching my arm at the elbow as we walked.
"I have this friend, you know, and he's a business fellow with a lot of dealings in the USA. Acha, what to say? He has a problem of his rupees to dollars cash flow, yeah? I was kind of hoping that you... A little bird told me that you are a helpful fellow when the cash is not flowing."
"I assume this cash should be in US dollars when it's flowing correctly."
"Yes," he smiled. "I'm very glad that you understand his problem."
"Just how badly is the flow backed up?"
"Oh, I think that about 10,000 should move things along very nicely."
I told him Khaled Ansari's current rate for US dollars, and he agreed to the terms. I arranged to meet him on the set the following day. He was to have the rupees,
a much larger bundle of notes than the American currency made, in a soft backpack, ready for me to collect on my bike. We shook on the deal. Mindful of the man I represented, Lord Abdel Kader Khan, a man whose name would never be mentioned by Mehta or by me, I put a slightly uncomfortable pressure in the handshake. It was a tiny pain I inflicted on him, the merest twinge, but it reinforced the hard eye contact above my amiable smile. "Don't start this if you're going to mess it up, Chandra," I warned, as the handshake pulsed from his pinched hand to his eyes. "Nobody likes to get jerked around. My friends, least of all."
"Oh, of course not, Baba," he joked,
not quite smothering the blip of alarm that spiked in his eyes.
"No problem. Koi baat nahi. Don't worry. I'm very grateful that you can help me, help my friend with his problem, yeah?"
We strolled back to the soundstage, and I found Lisa with Mehta's fellow producer, Cliff D'Souza.
"Hey, man, you'll do," Cliff said in greeting, seizing me by the arm and dragging me toward the tables on the nightclub set.
I looked at Lisa, but she just raised her hands in a gesture that said, "You're on your own, buddy."
"What's going on, Cliff?" "We need another guy, yeah? We need a guy, Agora, sitting between these two lovely girls." "Oh, no, you don't."
I resisted him, trying to wrestle myself out of his grip without actually hurting him. We were at the table. The two German girls stood and reached out to drag me into the seat between them.
"I can't do this. I don't act. I'm camera shy. I don't do this." "Na, komm schon. Hör auf," one of the girls said. "You're the one who told us yesterday how easy it is to do this, na?"
They were attractive women. I'd selected their group precisely because they were all healthy and attractive men and women. Their smiles were challenging me to join them. I thought about what it would mean. Taking part in a movie that about 300 million people in 10 or more countries would see while I was on the run as my country's most wanted man. It was foolish. It was dangerous.
"Ah, why the hell not?" I shrugged.
Cliff and the stagehands backed away as the cast members took their places on the set. The star, Chunky Pandey, was a handsome, athletic young Bombay guy. I'd seen him in a few of the movies I'd watched with my Indian friends, and I was surprised to discover that he was considerably more handsome and charismatic in person than he was on the screen. A makeup assistant held up a mirror while Chunky combed and fretted at his hair. The intensity of the gaze that he focused on the mirror was as steadfast as a surgeon's might be in the midst of a complex and critical procedure.
"You missed the best part," one of the German girls whispered to me. "It took this guy a big time to learn his dancing moves for this scene. He crept it up quite a few many times, and every time he crept it up, this little guy with the spiegel, the mirror, he pops out and we watch him with the hair combing all again. If they just used all that stuff of him crapping it up and combing his hair while the little guy holds the mirror, I tell you, this would be a big comedy hit."
The director of the film stood beside his cinematographer, poised with one eye to the lens of the camera, and then gave his last instructions to the lighting crew. At a signal, the director's assistant called for all quiet on the set. The cinematographer announced that the film was rolling.
"Cue sound," the director commanded. "And action!"
Music hammered into the set from large stadium speakers. It was the loudest that I'd ever heard Indian movie music played, and I loved it. The dancers, including the star, Kimi Katka, pranced onto the artificial stage. Working the set and the crowd of extras, Kimi sashayed across the stage and made her way from table to table, dancing and miming her number all the while. The hero joined in the dance and then ducked under a table when the actors playing the cops arrived. The whole sequence lasted only 5 minutes in the film, but it took all the morning to rehearse and most of the afternoon to shoot. My first taste of show business resulted in two brief sweeps of the camera that captured my wide smile as Kimi paused in her seductive routine at the back of my chair. We sent the foreign tourists home in two cabs, and Lisa rode back to town with me on the bullet. It was a warm evening, and she removed her jacket to ride, pulling the clip from her long hair. She wrapped her arms around my waist and pressed her cheek into my back. She was a good passenger, the kind who surrenders her will in unconditional trust and blends her body to the nuance of the rider. Through my thin white shirt, I felt the press of her breasts against my back. The shirt was open in the warm wind, and her hands clung to the tight skin of my waist. I never wore a helmet on the bike. There was a helmet clipped to the back of the seat for a passenger, but she chose not to wear it. Occasionally, when we stopped for the flow of traffic or to make a turn, a gust of wind whipped her long curly blonde hair over my shoulder and into my mouth. The perfume of verbena flowers lingered on my lips. Her thighs clung to me, gently, and with a promise or a threat of the strength they possessed. I remembered those thighs, the skin as soft as moonlight on the palm of my hand, that night at Carla's house. And then, as if she was reading my thoughts or joining them, she spoke when the bike stopped at a traffic signal.
"How's the kid?"
"The kid?"
"That little kid you had with you that night, you remember? At Carla's place?"
"He's fine. I saw him last week at his uncle's. He's not so little anymore. He's growing fast. He's at a private school. He doesn't like it much, but he'll do okay."
"Do you miss him?"
The signal changed, and I kicked the bike into gear, twisting the throttle to send us into the intersection on the staccato throbbing of the engine's growl. I didn't answer her. Of course I missed him. He was a good kid. I missed my daughter. I missed my mother and all of my family. I missed my friends. I missed them all, and I was sure, in those desperate years, that I would never see them again. Missing the people I loved was a kind of grieving for me. And it was worse, much worse, for the fact that, so far as I knew, they weren't dead. My heart sometimes was a graveyard full of blank stones. And when I was alone in my apartment, night after night, that grieving and missing choked me. There was money in bundles on the dressing table, and there were passports freshly forged that could send me anywhere. But there was nowhere to go. Nowhere that wasn't emptied of meaning and identity and love by the vacuum of those who were missing and lost forever. I was the fugitive. I was the vanished one. I was the one who was missing, missing in action. But inside the slipstream of my flight, they were the missing ones. Inside my exile, it was the whole world I once knew that was missing. The fugitive kind run, trying against their hearts to annihilate the past, and with it every telltale trace of what they were, where they came from, and those who once loved them. And they run into that extinction of themselves to survive. But they always fail. We can deny the past, but we can't escape its torment, because the past is a speaking shadow that keeps pace with the truth of what we are, step for step, until we die. And from the pink and purple palette of the perished evening, a blue-black night rose up around us as we rode. We plunged with the sea wind into tunnels of light. The robe of sunset slipped from the shoulders of the city. Lisa's hands moved on my hard skin like the sea, like the surging, swarming caress of the sea. And for a moment, as we rode together, we were one. One desire, one promise dissolving into compromise, one mouth tasting the trickle of danger and delight. And something, it might have been love or fear, goaded me to the choice, putting whispers in the warming wind. "This is as young and as free as you'll ever be." "I better go."
"Don't you want a coffee or something?" she asked,
her hand on the key in the door to her apartment. "I better go."
"Kavita's really into this story you gave her, about the girls from the slum, the girls who came back from the dead.
It's all she talks about. The Blue Sisters, she calls them. I don't know why she calls them that, but it's a pretty cool name. She was making conversation, holding me there. I looked into the sky that was her eyes. I better go. 2 hours later, fully awake, and still feeling the press of her lips in the goodnight kiss, I wasn't surprised when the phone rang.
"Can you come over right away?"
she said when I answered the call. I was silent, struggling to find a way to say no that sounded like yes.
"I've been trying to find Abdullah, but he doesn't answer," she went on.
And then I heard the flattened, frightened, shell-shocked drone in her voice. "What is it? What's happened?"
"We had some trouble. There was some trouble."
"Was it Maurizio? Are you okay?"
"He's dead," she mumbled. "I killed him."
"Is anyone there?"
"Anyone?"
she repeated vaguely. "Is anyone else there in the apartment?"
"No. I mean, yes, Ola's here. And him, on the floor. That's..."
"Listen," I commanded. "Lock the door. Don't let anyone in."
"The door's busted,"
she murmured, her voice weakening.
"He smashed the lock off the wall when he busted in here."
"Okay, push something up against the door, a chair or something. Keep it closed until I get there."
"Ola's a mess. She's pretty upset."
"It'll be okay. Just block the door. Don't phone anyone else. Don't speak to anyone and don't let anyone in. Make 2 cups of coffee with lots of milk and sugar, 4 spoons of sugar, and sit down with Ola to drink them. Give her a stiff drink as well if she needs it. I'm on my way. I'll be there in 10 minutes. Hang in there and stay cool." Riding the night, cutting into crowded streets, winding the bike into the web of lights, I felt nothing. No fear, no dread, no shiver of excitement. Redlining a motorcycle means opening the throttle so hard, with every change of gears, that the needle on the rev counter is twisted all the way round to the red zone of maximum revolutions. And that's what we were doing. All of us. In our different ways. Carla and Didier and Abdullah and I. We were redlining our lives. And Lisa. And Maurizio. Twisting the needle to the red zone. A Dutch mercenary in Kinshasa once told me that the only time he ever stopped hating himself was when the risk he faced became so great that he acted without thinking or feeling anything at all. I wished he hadn't said it to me because I knew exactly what he meant. And I rode that night. I soared that night. And the stillness in my heart was almost like being at peace.
Chapter 28. In my first knife fight, I learned that there are 2 kinds of people who enter a deadly conflict. Those who kill to live, and those who live to kill. The ones who like killing might come into a fight with most of the fire and fury. But the man or woman who fights just to live, who kills just to survive, will usually come out of it on top. If the killer type begins to lose the fight, his reason for fighting it fades. If the survivor type begins to lose, his reason for fighting it flares up fiercer than ever. And killing contests with deadly weapons, unlike common fistfights, are lost and won in the reasons that remain when the blood begins to run. The simple fact is that fighting to save a life is a better and more enduring reason than fighting to end one. My first knife fight was in prison. Like most prison fights, it started trivially and ended savagely. My adversary was a fit, strong veteran of many fights. He was a standover man, which meant that he mugged weaker men for money and tobacco. He inspired fear in most of the men,
and not burdened with judiciousness, he confused that fear with respect. I didn't respect him. I detest bullies for their cowardice and despise them for their cruelty. I never knew a tough man who preyed on the weak. Tough men hate bullies, almost as much as bullies hate tough men. And I was tough enough. I'd grown up in a rough working-class neighborhood, and I'd been fighting all my life. No one in the prison system knew that then, because I wasn't a career criminal, and I had no history. I began my prison experience as a first offender. What's more, I was an intellectual, and I sounded and acted like one. Some men respected that, and some ridiculed it, but none of them feared it. Nevertheless, the long prison sentence that I was serving, 20 years at hard labor for armed robberies, gave most of them pause. I was a dark horse. No one knew how I would respond to a real test, and more than a few were curious about it. The test, when it did come, was flashing steel and broken teeth and eyes rolling wide and wild as a frenzied dog. He attacked me in the prison laundry, the one place not observed directly by guards patrolling catwalks between the gun towers. It was the kind of unprovoked surprise attack that's known in prison slang as a sneak go. He was armed with a steel table knife, sharpened with endlessly malignant patience on the stone floor of his cell. Its edge was sharp enough to shave a man or cut his throat. I'd never carried a knife or used one in my life before prison. But in there, where men were attacked and stabbed every other day, I'd followed the advice of the hard men who'd survived long years there. It's better to have a weapon and not need it, they'd told me more than once, than need it and not have it. My knife was a sharpened spike of metal, about as thick as a man's finger and a little longer than a hand. The hilt was formed with packing tape and fitted into my hand without bunching the fingers. When the fight began, he didn't know that I was armed. But we both, in our separate ways, expected that it was a fight to the death. He wanted to kill me, and I was sure that I had to kill him to survive. He made two mistakes. The first was to fight on the back foot. In the surprise of his sneak attack, he'd first rushed at me, and with two slashes of the knife, he'd cut me across the chest and the forearm. He should have pressed on to finish it, hacking and tearing and stabbing at me. But he stepped back instead and waved the knife in little circles. He might have expected me to submit. Most of his foes surrendered quickly, defeated by their fear of him as much as by the sight of their own blood. He might have been so sure he would win that he was simply toying with me and teasing out the thrill of the kill. Whatever the reason, he lost the advantage, and he lost the fight in that first backward step. He gave me time to drag my knife from inside my shirt and shape up to box him. I saw the surprise in his eyes, and it was my cue to counterattack. His second mistake was that he held the knife as if it was a sword and he was in a fencing match. A man uses an underhand grip when he expects his knife, like a gun, to do the fighting for him. But a knife isn't a gun, of course. And in a knife fight, it isn't the weapon that does the fighting. It's the man. The knife is just there to help him finish it. The winning grip is the dagger hold, with the blade downward and the fist that holds it still free to punch. That grip gives a man maximum power in the downward thrust and an extra weapon in his closed fist. He dodged and weaved in a crouch, slashing the knife in sweeping arcs with his arms out wide. He was right-handed. I adopted a southpaw boxing stance, the dagger in my right fist. Stepping with the right foot and dragging the left to keep my balance, I took the fight to him. He ripped the blade at me twice and then lunged forward. I sidestepped and punched at him with a three-punch combination, right, left, right. One of them was a lucky punch. His nose broke, and his eyes watered and burned, blurring his vision. He lunged again and tried to bring the knife in from the side. I grabbed at his wrist with my left hand, stepped into the space between his legs, and stabbed him in the chest. I was trying for the heart or a lung. It didn't hit either one, but still I rammed the spike up to the hilt into the meaty flesh beneath his collarbone. It broke the skin of his back just below the shoulder blade.
He was jammed against a section of wall between a washing machine and a clothes dryer. Using the spike to hold him in place, and with my left hand locked to his knife wrist, I tried to bite his face and neck, but he whipped his head from side to side so swiftly that I opted for headbutts instead. Our heads cracked together several times, until one desperate wrenching effort of his legs sent us sprawling onto the floor together. He dropped his knife in the fall, but the spike tore free from his chest. He began to drag himself toward the door of the laundry. I couldn't tell if he was trying to escape or seeking a new advantage. I didn't take a chance. My head was level with his legs. Thrashing together on the ground, I reached up and grabbed the belt of his trousers. Using it for leverage, I stabbed him in the thigh twice, and again and again. I struck bone more than once, feeling the jarring deflection all the way up my arm. Releasing his belt, I stretched my left hand out for his knife, trying to reach it so that I could stab him with that one as well. He didn't scream. I'll say that much for him. He shouted hard for me to stop, and he shouted that he gave up. "I give up, I give up, I give up." But he didn't scream. I did stop, and I let him live. I scrambled to my feet. He tried again to crawl toward the door of the laundry. I stopped him with my foot on his neck and stomped down on the side of his head. I had to stop him. If he'd made it out of the laundry while I was there and the prison guards saw him, I would have spent 6 months or more in the punishment unit. While he lay there, groaning on the floor, I took off my bloody clothes and changed into a clean set. One of the prisoners who cleaned the jail was standing outside the laundry, grinning in at us through the doorway with unspiteful enjoyment. I passed him the bundle of my soiled clothes. He smuggled the bloodied clothes away in his mop bucket and threw them into the incinerator behind the kitchen. On my way out of the laundry, I handed the weapons to another man who buried them in the prison garden. When I was safely away from the scene, the man who tried to kill me limped into the prison chief's office and collapsed. He was taken to hospital. I never saw him again, and he never opened his mouth. I'll say that much for him, too. He was a thug and a standover man, and he tried to kill me for no good reason. But he wasn't an informer. Alone in my cell after the fight, I examined my wounds. The gash on my forearm had made a clean cut through a vein. I couldn't report it to the medical officer, because that would have connected me to the fight and the wounded man. I had to hope that it would heal. There was a deep slash from my left shoulder to the center of my chest. It was also a clean cut, and it was bleeding freely. I burned 2 packets of cigarette papers all the way down to white ash in a metal bowl, and rubbed the ash into both wounds. It was painful, but it sealed the wounds immediately and stopped the bleeding. I never spoke of the fight to anyone, but most of the men knew about it soon enough, and they all knew that I'd survived the test. The white scar on my chest, the scar that men saw every day in the prison shower, reminded them of my willingness to fight. It was a warning, like the bright bands of color on the skin of a sea snake. It's still there, that scar, as long and white after all these years as it ever was. And it's still a kind of warning. I touch it, and I see the killer pleading for his life. I remember, reflected in the fright-filled domes of his eyes, fate's mirror, the sight of the twisted, hating thing that I became in the fight. My first knife fight wasn't my last. And as I stood over Maurizio Belcane's dead body, I felt the cold, sharp memory of my own experiences of stabbing and being stabbed. He was face down in a kneeling posture, with his upper body on a corner of the couch and his legs on the floor. Beside his slackly folded right hand, there was a razor-sharp stiletto resting on the carpet. A black-handled carving knife was buried to the crank in his back, a little to the left of his spine and just below the shoulder blade. It was a long, wide, sharp knife. I'd seen that knife before, in Lisa's hand, the last time Maurizio had made the mistake of coming to the apartment uninvited.
That was one lesson he should have learned the first time. We don't, of course. It's okay, Carla once said, because if we all learned what we should learn the first time round, we wouldn't need love at all. Well, Maurizio had learned that lesson in the end, the hard way, face down in his own blood. He was what Didier called a fully mature man. When I'd chided Didier once for being immature, he'd told me that he was proud and delighted to be immature. The fully mature man or woman, he said, has about 2 seconds left to live. Those thoughts rolled over one another in my mind like the steel balls in Captain Queeg's hand. It was the knife that did it, of course. The memory of stabbing and being stabbed. I remembered the vivid seconds every time I'd been stabbed. I remembered the knives cutting me, entering my body. I could still feel the steel blades inside me. It was like burning. It was like hate. It was like the most evil thought in the world. I shook my head and breathed in deeply and looked at him again. The knife might have ruptured a lung and penetrated to the heart. Whatever it had done, it had finished him fast. His body had fallen onto the couch, and once there, he'd hardly moved at all. I took a handful of his thick black hair and lifted his head. His dead eyes were half open, and his lips were pulled back slightly from his teeth in a rictal smile. There was remarkably little blood. The couch had absorbed the big spill. "We've got to get rid of the couch," I heard myself thinking. The carpet had suffered no great damage and could be cleaned. The room was also a little disturbed by the violence. A leg was broken on the coffee table, and the locks on the front door hung askew. I turned my attention to the women. Ulla bore a cut on her face from the cheekbone almost to the chin. I cleaned the wound and pressed it together with tape all along the length of it. The cut wasn't deep, and I expected it to heal quickly, but I was sure it would leave a scar. By chance, the blade had followed the natural curve of her cheek and jaw, adding a flash of emphasis to the shape of her face. Her beauty was injured by the wound, but not ravaged by it. Her eyes, however, were abnormally wide and pierced with a terror that refused to fade. There was a lungi on the arm of the couch beside her. I put it around her shoulders, and Lisa gave her a cup of hot, sweet chai. When I covered Maurizio's body with a blanket, she shuddered. Her face crumpled into puckers of pain, and she cried for the first time. Lisa was calm. She was dressed in a pullover and jeans, an outfit that only a Bombay native could wear on such a humid, still and hot night. There was the mark of a blow around her eye and on her cheek. When Ulla was quiet again, we crossed the room to stand near the door, out of her hearing. Lisa took a cigarette, bent her head to light it from my match, and then exhaled, looking directly into my face for the first time since I'd entered the apartment.
"I'm glad you came. I'm glad you're here. I couldn't help it. I had to do it. He..."
"Stop it, Lisa," I interrupted her. The tone was harsh, but my voice was quiet and warm. "You didn't stab him. She did. I can see it in her eyes. I know the look. She's still stabbing him now, still going over it in her mind. She'll have that look for a while. You're trying to protect her, but you won't help her by lying to me." She smiled. Under the circumstances, it was a very good smile. If we hadn't been standing next to a dead man with a knife in his heart, I would have found it irresistible. "What happened?"
"I don't want her to get hurt, that's all," she replied evenly.
The smile closed up in the thin, grim line of her pursed lips. "Neither do I." "What happened?"
"He busted in, slashed her up. He was crazy, out of his mind. I think he was on something. He was screaming at her and she couldn't answer him. She was even crazier than he was. I spent an hour with her before he crashed in here. She told me about Medina. I'm not surprised she was crazy. Fuck, Lynn, it's a bad story. She was out of her mind because of it. Anyway, he crashed through the door like a gorilla, and he slashed her. He was covered in blood. Medina's, I think. It was pretty fucking scary. I tried to jump him with a knife from the kitchen. He socked me pretty good in the eye and knocked me on my ass. I fell on the couch. He got on top of me, and he was just about to start on me with that switchblade of his when Ulla gave it to him in the back. He was dead in a second. I swear, a second. 1 second, just like that. He was looking at me, then he was dead. She saved my life, Lynn.
I think it's more likely that you saved hers, Lisa. If you weren't here, it would be her hugging the couch with a knife in her back. She began to tremble and shiver. I took her in my arms and held her for a while, supporting her weight. When she was calm again, I brought her a kitchen chair, and she sat down shakily. I phoned around and found Abdullah. Explaining what had happened in as few words as possible, I told him to contact Hassan Obikwa in the African ghetto and bring him to the apartment with a car. Little by little, as we waited for Abdullah and Hassan, the story emerged. Ulla was suddenly tired, but I couldn't let her sleep. Not yet. After a while, she began to speak, adding a detail here and there to Lisa's account, and then gradually telling the whole story herself. Maurizio Belcane met Sebastian Modena in Bombay, where both of them made money from the work they arranged for foreign prostitutes. Maurizio was the only son of rich Florentine parents, who died in a plane crash when he was a child. By his own account, repeated to Ulla whenever he was drunk, he was raised with indifferent duteousness by distant relatives who tolerated him reluctantly in the loveless shelter of their home. At 18, he seized the first tranche of his inheritance and fled to Cairo. By the age of 25, he'd squandered the fortune left to him by his parents. The remnants of his family cast him out, no less for his penury than for the many scandals that had pursued his profligate progress through the Middle East and Asia. At 27, he found himself in Bombay, brokering sex for European prostitutes. The point man for Maurizio's operation in Bombay was the diffident dour Spaniard, Sebastian Modena. The 30-year-old sought out and approached wealthy Arab and Indian customers. His short, slight frame and timid manner worked to his advantage, putting the customers at ease by allaying their fears and suspicions. He took 1/5 of the cut that Maurizio claimed from the foreign girls. Ulla believed that Modena was happy enough in the unequal relationship, where he did most of the dirty work and Maurizio took most of the dirty money, because he saw himself as a pilot fish and the tall, handsome Italian as a shark. His background was very different to Maurizio's. One of 13 children in an Andalusian gypsy family, Modena had grown up with a notion of himself as the runt of the litter. Schooled more in crime than in scholarship, and barely literate, he'd worked his way from swindle to grift to petty larceny across Turkey, Iran, Pakistan, and India. He preyed on tourists, never taking too much and never remaining too long in any one place. Then he met Maurizio, and for 2 years he pandered for the pimp, procuring clients and putting them together with the girls in Maurizio's stable. They might have gone on in that way for much longer, but one day Maurizio walked into Leopold's with Ulla. From the first moment that their eyes met, Ulla told us, she knew that Modena was hopelessly in love with her. She encouraged him because his devotion to her was useful. She'd been purchased from Madame Jo's palace, and Maurizio was determined to recover his investment costs as quickly as possible. He'd instructed the smitten Modena to find work for her twice a day, every day, until the debt was repaid. Tortured by what he saw as betrayals of his own love,
Modena pressed his partner to release Ulla from the obligation. Maurizio refused, ridiculing the Spaniard's affection for a working girl, and insisting that he put her to work day and night. Ulla paused in her story when a tap at the door announced Abdullah's arrival. The tall Iranian entered silently, dressed in black like a thing made from the night itself. He greeted me with a hug and nodded gently to Lisa. She came forward and kissed him on the cheek. He lifted the blanket to look at Maurizio's body, nodding and turning down the corners of his mouth in professional approval of the single killing thrust. He let the blanket fall and muttered a prayer.
"Hassan is busy. He will be here after about 1 hour," he said.
"Did you tell him what I want him to do?"
"He knows," he replied, raising one eyebrow in a tight smile.
"Is it still quiet outside?"
"I checked before I came inside. The building is quiet, and the street all around."
"There's been no reaction from the neighbors so far. He took the door out with one kick," Lisa says, "and there wasn't all that much shouting and screaming. There was loud music playing next door when I got here. It was a party or something. I don't think anyone knows about this."
We have to call someone,"
Ulla shouted suddenly, standing and letting the lungi fall from her shoulders.
"We should call a doctor, tell the police."
Abdullah sprinted to her and wrapped her in his arms with surprisingly tender compassion. He sat her down again and rocked her, murmuring reassuringly. I watched them with a little pinch of shame, because I knew that I should have comforted her myself, long before that, and in just the same gentle way. But the fact was that Maurizio's death had compromised me, and I was afraid. I'd had reason enough to want him dead, and I'd beaten him with my fists for it. That was, in other words, a motive for murder. People knew that. I was there in the room with Lisa and Ulla, and it seemed that I was helping them, responding to their call for help. But that wasn't all of it. I was also there to help myself. I was there to make sure that no part of the sticky web of his death clung to me. And that's why there was nothing gentle in me, and all the tenderness came from an Iranian killer named Abdullah Tahiri. Ulla began to speak again. Lisa poured her a drink of vodka and lime juice. She gulped at it and went on with her story. It took quite a while because she was nervous and afraid. She skipped important details from time to time, and she was loose with her chronology, ordering the facts as they occurred to her in the telling, rather than as they'd happened. We had to ask questions and prompt her into a more sequential account. But little by little, we got it all. Modena had been the first to meet the Nigerian, the businessman who'd wanted to spend $60,000 on heroin. He introduced him to Maurizio, and too quickly, too easily, the African had parted with his money. Maurizio stole the money and planned to move on, but Modena had other ideas. He seized his chance to free Ulla and rid himself of Maurizio, the man he resented for enslaving her. He snatched the money from him and went into hiding, prompting the Nigerian to send his hit squad to Bombay to distract the understandably bloodthirsty Africans while he searched for Modena. Maurizio had given them my name and told them I'd stolen their money. Abdullah and I knew the next part of that story well enough. For all his cringing cowardice with me and his dread that the Nigerians might return to hunt him down, Maurizio Belcane couldn't cut his losses and leave the city. He couldn't rid his heart of the killing rage he felt for Modena and the righteous lust he felt for the money they'd stolen together. For weeks, he watched Ulla and followed her everywhere. He knew that sooner or later, Modena would contact her. When the Spaniard did make that contact, Ulla went to him. Without realizing it, she also led the crazed Italian to the cheap Dardar Hotel, where his former partner was hiding.
Maurizio burst into the room, but he found Modena alone. Ulla was gone. The money was gone. Modena was ill. Some sickness had ruined him. Ulla thought it might have been malaria. Maurizio gagged him, tied him to the sickbed, and went to work on him with the stiletto. Modena, tougher than anyone knew and taciturn to the end, refused to tell him that Ulla was hiding in an adjoining room, only footsteps away, with all the money.
When Maurizio stopped with the knife, the cutting, and left the room, I waited for a long time,
Ulla said, staring at the carpet and shivering beneath the blanket. Lisa was sitting on the floor at her feet. She gently prized the glass from Ulla's fingers and gave her a cigarette. Ulla accepted it, but she didn't smoke. She looked into Lisa's eyes and craned her neck around to look into Abdullah's face and then mine.
I was so afraid, she pleaded. I was too much afraid. After a time, I went into the room and I saw him. He was lying on the bed. There was the rag tied on his mouth. He was tied up to the bed, and he could move only his head. He was cut up all over, on his face, on his body, everywhere. There was so much blood, so much blood. He kept looking at me with his black eyes, staring and staring. I left him there, and I ran away.
You just left him there? Lisa gasped.
She nodded.
You didn't even untie him?
She nodded again.
Jesus Christ,
Lisa spat out bitterly. She looked up, moving her anguished eyes from Abdullah's face to mine and back again.
She didn't tell me that part of it.
Ulla, listen to me. Do you think he might still be there? I asked. She nodded a third time. I looked at Abdullah. I have a good friend in Dadar, he said. Where is the hotel? What is the name?
I don't know, she mumbled. It's next to a market, at the back, where they throw the rubbish away. The smell is very bad. No, wait, I remember. I said the name in the taxi. It is called Kabir's. That's it. That's the name. Oh, God, when I left him, I just thought I was sure they would find him and make him free. Do you think he might be on that bed until now? Do you think?
Abdullah phoned his friend and arranged to have someone check the hotel. Where's the money? I demanded. She hesitated. The money, Ulla. Give it to me. She stood up shakily, supported by Lisa, and walked into the bedroom she'd used. Moments later, she returned with a travel flight bag. She handed it to me, her expression strangely contradictory. Coquette and adversary in equal parts. I opened the bag and took out several bundles of American $100 bills. I counted out $20,000 and pushed the rest into the bag. I returned the bag to her. $10,000 is for Hassan, I declared. $5,000 is to get you a new passport and a ticket to Germany. $5,000 is to clean up here and set Lisa up in a new apartment on the other side of town. The rest is yours. And Medina's, if he makes it. She wanted to reply, but a soft tap at the door announced Hassan's arrival. The stocky, thickly muscled Nigerian entered and greeted Abdullah and me warmly. Like the rest of us, he was acclimatized to Bombay's heat, and he wore a heavy serge jacket and bottle-green jeans with no trace of discomfort. He pulled the blanket from Maurizio's body and pinched the skin, flexed the dead arm, and sniffed at the corpse.
I got a good plastic, he said,
dumping a heavy plastic drop sheet onto the floor and unfolding it.
We got to take off all them clothes. And any of his rings and chains. Just the man. That's all we want. We'll pull the teeth later.